It's Wednesday, May 27th. I'm Oscar Ramirez in Los Angeles, and this is The Daily Dive. The economy is slowly starting to come back, and hopefully, the worst of the shutdown is over. For the first time since forced shutdowns began in March, spending on hotels, restaurants, and airlines are picking up. While there is some uncertainty going forward with high unemployment and consumer spending, we are hoping that we have hit peak economic loss. Harriet Torrey, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, joins us for more. Next, hair salons and barbershops can now reopen in California. LA County will still have to wait a little longer, though. But while things have been shut down, there has been an underground world of haircuts. Barbers and stylists have made house calls under fear of potential penalties, and people have gotten freshened up under fear of potential shaming. Emily Guerin, reporter for KPCC and LAS.com, joins us for how people got their haircuts despite quarantine. Finally, some people haven't seen or touched others for 3 months because of COVID-19. And while the country is in the beginning stages of getting back out there, some will continue to isolate. Alan Gomez, reporter for USA Today, joins us for how some in the elderly and medically vulnerable communities and those skeptical of their government's reopening plans are keeping the quarantine going. It's news without the noise. Let's dive in.
Working closely with the governors, we are beginning to open the economy in a way that minimizes risk to workers and customers. We expect economic conditions to improve in the third and fourth quarter and into next year.
Joining us now is Harriet Torrey, economics reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us, Harriet.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about the economy this past weekend. It just seemed like everybody was really starting to try to get back to normal. As we've been going through this coronavirus pandemic, the first thing we were looking for was hitting that peak of number of cases. Now it seems like we're hitting that peak as far as peak economic damage, those peak economic losses, and things are starting to reopen. It seems like we're starting to get a little bit of good news on that front, although we are still expecting some type of slow recovery to get back to the way we were. So, Harriet, tell us a little bit about it. What are we seeing as good indicators right now?
The official data that we get from the U.S. government, we get it with a lag of sort of 4 to 6 weeks. So we don't have anything really much yet to say that we've seen that's official from April and May. However, we get a lot of real-time indicators from sort of private companies and things like that. And that is suggesting that things probably bottomed out in the middle of April. And on the consumer side, early May, we had Mother's Day, which is a big spending event. And then, of course, just this past weekend was Memorial Day. And we really see some suggestions that things are beginning to pick up after bottoming out. So, for instance, we can see diners at restaurants, and there's been a slight uptick in that. The number of people traveling through TSA airport checkpoints also picking up. But it is worth bearing in mind that these numbers are still kind of 80 to 90% below what they were this time a year ago.
One of the industries that you focused on in your piece was the shipping industry as a point that it illustrating this kind of come back the best, at least. Explain that a little bit.
This is just a sign that things are starting to get moving again. So we have some indicators on the trucking spot market, and these have been picking up for 4 straight weeks. People are just moving more stuff around. Freight is getting underway again. Again, we had some companies that said that things were very slow at the start of April, but demand has remained fairly steady since then, which is another sign that hopefully the worst is behind us.
One of the other interesting points was the real estate industry. A lot of the conversation was saying, why aren't home prices going down? Although insurance rates were probably going really low, all-time lows and all that, and attracting a lot of first-time buyers, the housing prices weren't necessarily dropping down. But we're starting to see some good activity there as well.
Yeah, we're just beginning to see suggestions that people are feeling more comfortable going out and looking for a new home. And part of this could be pent-up demand. You know, we had essentially from the middle of March, everything was in lockdown. And traditionally, the spring is usually the hot time for the housing market. That didn't happen this year. There are signs of pent-up demand and people beginning to do more searches, beginning to look for a new place to live. And it was interesting because some of the people I spoke to for the story said that there are potentially two reasons for that. One is that mortgage rates are very, very low. So borrowing costs are low. You can get a good deal on a mortgage. But the other thing is we've been spending so much time at home during this coronavirus lockdown that people are really beginning to see their home as a potential space, not just for living and sleeping, but for working every day. And so people are looking for a nice place to call home. They feel like they need perhaps a home office, or maybe a home gym or a yard, because the coronavirus pandemic and the fact that everyone's had to be at home has made everyone kind of think more about what they want from a home.
So we are getting some good indicators, some good real-time data. We have to wait for some official numbers for a little bit longer, but there is still a lot of uncertainty. I know that the recovery still will be kind of slow. It's not going to bounce back as a lot of people would hope. And consumer spending is a big part of that. Talk to me about that, and also about unemployment, because that seems like it will linger a long time and people need to get back to work before they can really start spending again.
Yes, and these two things kind of go hand in hand, because consumer spending really drives the US economy. And in order for consumers to feel comfortable spending, one of the things that they need is income, so having a job. I mean, people are getting expanded unemployment benefits, but that doesn't compensate for getting a regular paycheck. And the hit to the labor market has been absolutely enormous. It's without modern precedent. We've had nearly 40 million people apply for first-time unemployment benefits in the past couple of months. So the reason why economists are talking about potentially a slow recovery is because they're worried that some of the jobs that were lost as a result of the coronavirus pandemic shutdowns won't be recovered, that they will be lost permanently, because many businesses are going to struggle to reopen, restaurants and et cetera, retailers. So it's kind of like the two things are going to have to go hand in hand. So the things that will have to happen first and foremost, economists say, is for the economy to recover, we need to get over the pandemic. That, you know, the healthcare situation is really important. So we either need a vaccine, or the number of new infections needs to go down enough that people feel safe venturing out of their houses and, for instance, going back to malls and restaurants and going out and spending again. That in turn, once people start to feel comfortable venturing out, that should hopefully prompt hiring. You know, for instance, instead of just a business owner doing everything him or herself behind the counter, perhaps that person will need to staff up, hire a few more staff to meet demand at their store or their restaurant as business starts to come back. But this could be a slow process. So that's kind of the concern for economists, that we fell into a hole very quickly and it could take longer to climb back out of this hole.
Harriet Torrey, economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
I think it's pretty obvious to you I have not had a haircut. I'm a little embarrassed having this conversation as publicly as I am having. So the answer is no. There was an experiment with Brooklyn, my daughter, where she did offer, because she was a bit embarrassed, quote unquote, with her father, she offered to cut it.
Joining us now is Emily Guerin, reporter for KPCC and LAist.com. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
No problem.
There's actually some good news right now in California. A lot of counties are starting to move into stage three of the governor's plan for reopening. And in particular, hair salons, barbershops can now start reopening. Although in Los Angeles County, we're not in that stage just yet. So there will be some time before that kind of reopens. But Emily, you wrote a piece about the fear of shaming and the need for people to make their living and this kind of underground world of haircuts, of people getting their haircuts, whether it be the people that need to get their haircuts or the barbers and cosmetologists and stylists that need to go out there and get some cuts done just to make a living and continue making some money. It's actually a very interesting story. So Emily, tell us a little bit about it. And if you have any new information about Governor Newsom's plans for reopening, feel free to fill us in.
So I started noticing a couple weeks ago, these barber shops on Lincoln Boulevard near where I live in the sort of Venice, Santa Monica area, they would be kind of covered with butcher paper, like the windows were taped up, but it seemed like there was someone inside. I saw once a couple sort of freshly shaven men walking out of one of them. And I was like, okay, like I think something's going on here. And then coincidentally, just a few days later, my hairstylist emailed and said he was making home visits and he had this sort of traveling kit and he had a whole plan to stay safe. And so I just started thinking like, this must be happening everywhere. And I did a quick Craigslist search and quickly found a number of posts of stylists in Los Angeles who were either offering home visits or had sort of converted their own garages or living rooms into basically clandestine barbershops.
And I'm sure this is happening across the entire country. I know for myself specifically, I grew a beard during quarantine, so I need to get that fixed up by somebody.
Right.
My hair is going crazy. In the middle of this whole thing, I had my wife cut my hair. She did a great job, but it wasn't done by a professional. So I've been in this mode where I'm dying to go get a good shave and a good cut. But you know that this was going down. You can see it when people have that fresh cut and it's like, hey, where'd you get that? And they're like, ah, you know, I know a guy or something like that.
Well, what's interesting about that too is, you know, if you're a politician and you're routinely going on Zoom calls or Facebook Live to give these coronavirus updates, like people are scrutinizing them based on their appearance.
Oh, yeah.
So I was listening into a public meeting in Orange County where a woman who's a salon owner got up and she was just like, I'm a hairstylist. I can tell that a number of you have gotten our services in the past few weeks, yet you don't consider us essential enough to reopen. Kind of what's up with that? And one of the supervisors shot back, like, if you want a close up, you can tell that I have not had a haircut. Just come see me afterwards.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some risk of looking too groomed as a public official while salons are required to be closed.
And that was a big conversation, whether it was essential or not. And, you know, obviously in the industry, it requires one of the closest person-to-person contacts that you can imagine. Somebody is physically touching you while they're working on your hair and all that. So that was always a big part of the conversation and why public officials deemed them not essential and why they've been so late in the process to reopen. You spoke to a lot of people that had to cross the boundary and some people that needed work anyways. One person in particular, she was getting tested every week. She was posting screenshots of her results on Craigslist, and she even kind of created her own contact tracing network, at least getting the information of people in case she needed to notify somebody.
So she was an employee at a salon and she was furloughed in March and was mistakenly informed by her manager that she was not eligible for unemployment. So she went 6 or 8 weeks without any kind of money coming in. And during this time, she decided to place an ad on Craigslist and start cutting hair in her living room. She does mostly men's haircuts. And yeah, I mean, between clients, she sanitizes all of her tools. She vacuums and mops the floor. She wears a mask. She makes the clients wear a mask. She wears gloves. And her whole take was like, look, I didn't really have any other option. I wasn't getting any government aid. My rent is still due. Like, put yourself in my shoes. You know, what would you do if you were me?
There's another story that was kind of funny where I guess somebody was doing a home visit, but she had to wheel in the big hair dryer, you know, with the big
right. She was doing a blowout, like a Brazilian blowout.
Yeah, the big dome style hair dryer. Exactly.
She was a little bit more paranoid. I would say the first woman we just talked about, Carmel, she was kind of like, you know, I know that the State Board of Cosmetology would punish me if they knew, but like, really, what are my options? My hands are tied. Whereas this other stylist I spoke with felt much more anxious. She said she could have done a lot more home visits than she was doing, but she was just afraid of getting caught. And she's a salon owner, so maybe she felt like the consequences for her would be higher.
To my knowledge, there hasn't really been any enforcement of penalties. I guess the California Board of Barbering and Cosmetology had gotten about 651 complaints.
Yeah, that's right.
But I hadn't really seen anything as far as any type of punishments.
Well, and I asked the Los Angeles mayor, Eric Garcetti, about this, and he said that they would be hesitant to kind of resort to penalties right away. They'd rather try to educate people if they found out that they were doing these clandestine haircuts.
Emily, just last thing, I saw that you have a new podcast that's coming out in July. Tell us a little bit about it.
Basically, it's called California City. It's about the town of California City, which is this sort of, you could say it's sort of a failed master plan community. And for the past 60 years, various developers have been sort of making this promise that if you buy land here, you'll get rich one day. It'll be worth something someday. And it just has not panned out. So it's sort of a story about kind of the dark side of this American dream.
And when does it come out?
It comes out on July 13th. And you can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Perfect. Well, hopefully we can get you back on to talk a little bit more about it closer to launch. Emily Guerin, reporter for KPCC and LAS.com. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, that anxiety, that constant, that stress that you may have from being alone may lead to all sorts of physical problems, and they find increased, more rapid mortality among people who are isolated, who are lonely.
Joining us now is Alan Gomez, reporter for USA Today. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
As the country is starting to reopen, people are starting to get back out there. There's still a big segment of people that are isolating, and we're getting into 3 months now. Some of these people can be doing because they're elderly, they might be medically vulnerable, or just scared to get out and back to normal yet, scared of the coronavirus and what it can do. Alan, you wrote an article about how really, you know, humans aren't meant to be alone so much. And there's still this segment of people that are isolating, that haven't really had that human contact for quite some time now. So, Alan, tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, as we started seeing all these different states move to reopen their economies, you know, this isn't a analysis of whether that's a good idea or bad. It's just we realize that there are just thousands and thousands, possibly millions of people who have been isolated all this time and who have no intentions of joining that reopening parade. And it's just been fascinating talking to these folks, just kind of what they're experiencing. As you can imagine, a lot of depression, a lot of isolation, a lot of missing the grandkids and their children. But it was really good to see some flickers of hope in there, like things that they're doing to kind of get through. And I can tell you just personally, I learned a lot of lessons from these folks about how to get through this.
Tell us a little bit about some of this, because there was a study that was being done about how quickly this forced isolation from the pandemic was affecting people. I know you spoke to a few people that were part of this study.
Yeah, it's, you know, I spoke to this one professor at a BYU. Her name's Juliana Holt Lundstedt, and she has studied loneliness as part of her career. So she'd studied this well before this pandemic came on. And so what they found previously was that it's not just a mental thing. Isolation, loneliness, it doesn't just affect you mentally. It's something that can have physical effects on people. It can raise your blood pressure. It can, you know, that anxiety, that constant, that stress that you may have from being alone may lead to all sorts of physical problems. And they find increased, more rapid mortality among people who are isolated, who are lonely. So they're quickly diving in to see how quickly those kind of symptoms can appear in people based on their isolation. It's not something they'd studied before. Before it was just sort of like, okay, this person is isolated. Let's look at how they do compared to somebody who's not. But now they're trying to ramp up, and it's an international effort with researchers from around the country trying to see how quickly those kind of symptoms can really start materializing in people. Is it a month? Is it 2 months? Is it 3 months? So they're trying to take a close look at what that's doing. We hear a lot about sort of the mental problems that come with it. You know, just straight depression is something that a lot of people have described when they're in those situations. And those are very easy to identify. Those are mental things that we can see. But it's that question of how it affects these people mentally or physically, excuse me, and whether that can lead to some, you know, pretty drastic effects on them down the road.
You know, you spoke to a lot of people, you know, how they were dealing with their isolation. And all of them said that, you know, they were finding certain reasons for hope, whether it be, you know, I need to force myself to get out and see my grandson, or I just need to get out and experience nature and kind of center myself that way. There was a lot of different stories you came across.
Yeah, it was interesting. And there's a ton more examples that we couldn't get into the article. But it's, you know, one of the ones we mentioned was this 77-year-old woman who for 8 years has been trying to write a book. And finally, it was during this quarantine that she got the peace and quiet that she needed to finally finish. So that was just a really, you know, a lot of these people I expected to speak to, it would be sort of very, you know, sad interviews talking about just what they're enduring. But really, most of the people I spoke to, you know, talked about finding those things that to sort of brighten their day, to help them get through it. One gentleman who lived in Georgia who had moved to this small mountain town and really hadn't gone up into the mountains all that much, kind of one day he just realized, wait a second, why did I move up here in the first place? And just took a drive into the mountains, jumped into a river, and just said he had the time of his life.
As states are opening up and all the people that you spoke to, did you get a sense that most of them were ready to get back to it, or they're still going to continue to isolate?
Since the ones I spoke to were doing so for very specific reasons, being elderly, having some sort of pre-existing medical condition, most of the people I spoke to just are not going anywhere. Some of them just don't trust their local governments that they're going to put in place a responsible reopening plan. A lot of them talked about like, hey, I went out to the store one time and half the people weren't wearing masks. I ain't going back out there again, you know. And so it's this combination of suspicion of either the local government or their neighbors but not taking this seriously enough. But for a lot of them, it really sounded like they'd sort of, okay, now that they've settled into this, now that they've kind of figured out how they're going to get by, now that they've figured out how to get food, how to entertain themselves, how to keep themselves sane during this, they just don't see a reason why they're going to suddenly break all that, jump out into a restaurant and just risk being exposed when we just have so many cases still out there in the country.
Alan Gomez, reporter for USA Today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for today. Join us on social media. at Daily Dive Pod on both Twitter and Instagram. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow us on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcast. This episode of The Daily Dive is produced by Victor Wright and engineered by Tony Sorrentino. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and this was your Daily Dive.